First of all, to introduce myself, I'm Pamela J. Smith. The company is MythWorks. It is a global consultation and resource company serving individuals, organizations, the media arts, and the military, using ancient wisdom, new science, consciousness research, and what I have termed the proven power tools of creativity. So what I'm going to present here this evening are some of these tools. We're going to talk about tools of perception, focus, magic, creativity, balance, leadership, and empowerment. As you go through this evening, I'd like you to keep in your mind those questions that are on the flyer. Who are they? Why are they important? How can you become one, raise one, love one, and create them in your storytelling? Because a lot of the information will be applicable to various of those aspects. So we'll cover it sort of in pods, but you'll find a lot of things cross-fertilizing each other. Now, how I start most of my talks, and particularly ones to the military, is to say, don't believe anything I tell you. Okay? Because belief is an emotion that takes the place of knowledge. Keep an open mind, but keep a skeptical mind. See what the information fits in with what you already know. If it's something that totally goes against what you already know, try to keep an open mind. Stick it on a shelf and maybe you'll find something a little bit later on that you can hook it up with and go, oh yeah, I see. Now, the wisdom teachings have been around for, thousands and thousands of years, and some say much, much longer, back into the mists of time and legend. And used to, you'd have to go sit up in a cave in the Himalayas for 10 years in the snow eating cold rice and sour yak milk to get this kind of information. But in the last couple of decades, the secret teachings have been made available. And if any of you came to the Bodhi tree 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you know how much this thirst for this knowledge and this wisdom has blossomed, and there's just tons more of it out there. So the wisdom teachings are the foundation for religion, philosophy, a lot of science. As you'll find, I've got about 3 feet of a bookshelf at home that's written by physicists about spirituality and plasma physics as the etheric network, and you know, Einstein and how his work ties in with the Vedic writings. Okay, so we're seeing all of this blossom now. So we'll find what used to be the secret teachings out there everywhere. Esoteric is a word you'll hear me use quite a bit. It simply means hidden. It's the information that used to be secret, and you had to go through all these initiations in order to learn it, whether you were studying to be a priest in Egypt, or you were going through the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece, or Sumerian, or Vedic, or whatever. So a lot of the stuff that was esoteric, i.e. hidden, is now coming out. And sometimes you'll hear me say something that might sound totally counter to conventional exoteric information. That's because the wisdom used to be cloaked, so that even if it slipped out, it couldn't be misused by the hoveling masses or by people who had their own agenda and would not have used it wisely. So the purpose of making people go through initiations was to test their integrity and to test their intent and to be sure that some of these very, very powerful tools didn't get into the wrong hands. And what you see a lot now also out in the marketplace are distillations of these things with like science of the mind, visualization techniques. These are all versions of what used to be the hidden secret teachings. If you happen to watch the news or read a newspaper, you notice that the world is changing drastically, radically. We often say it's the good news, bad news joke. The bad news is the world as we know it is falling apart around us. The good news is the world as we know it is falling apart around us. We have an opportunity to remake it. That's the good news. Okay? So do not despair when things seem really, really wretched out there or in your own personal lives. See it as an opportunity to become a conscious creator. And that's what being an alpha babe is about. A lot of people who have helped determine the course of civilization in times like this, times of great turmoil and times of change, have been alpha babes, outstanding human beings who exemplify the higher qualities of integrity, daring, innovation, honor, interconnectedness, caring, loyalty, and vision, but just happen to be housed in a female body. And these are just the kind of people we need now more of on the planet. So we're going to take a look then at who they are, why are they important, how can we become one, love one, and raise them, and then also create them in our storytelling. How many people here are storytellers? Actors, writers, directors, producers? Okay. So keep in mind as we go through here that you can use a lot of these examples as, you know, sort of icons and archetypes for your storytelling. And as we get a little bit deeper into it, you'll get even more specific tools.
Now, as we go through this evening, I will often say man or human instead of woman or she. But let me explain something. In the Sanskrit language, which is one of the oldest languages on the planet, man means think, the person who thinks. The root word is manas, which means mind stuff, that mental plane stuff, thought forms. So the word man simply means thinker. It has no gender, okay? So let's just put that aside and realize that when we say man, we mean human being who thinks, okay? So, who and what are alpha babes? Out in the blue Caribbean waters is a species of fish called the bluehead wrasse. And like a lot of species of animals, they go around in groups, or herds, or schools, in the case of fish. Now, the schools are headed, as a lot of groups are, by an alpha male, who is like the totally baddest dude. And he's got the harem, and he's the daddy of most of the little kids, and he protects the territory, and everything revolves around him. And then behind him, there is an alpha female who is the head female of the group and sort of keeps everybody in line. And then there's the beta female, and then you have the juvenile males, and you've got the little babies. And so the school goes along doing what it does. Well, interestingly enough, if you take the alpha male out of the school of fish, just physically remove him, something extremely interesting happens. The alpha female very quickly changes sex and becomes the alpha male, complete to being able to make babies. There is a complete and total change of gender. Now, the interesting part about that is that it happens first in the brain chemistry and in behavior before it happens in the gonads, which is something that scientists are still trying to figure out. What does this exactly mean? Okay. Yes. Now, the hormone arginine vasitocin, or AVT, increases dramatically when this change occurs. In humans, there are two hormones which are very similar to this same one. So what this is beginning to do is to throw into a cocked hat the whole idea that aggressive male behavior, quote-unquote, is a product of testosterone. Maybe not. Okay, there may be something more at work here. So now you got the school of fish and everybody's moved up a notch. Okay, what happens if you throw an alpha male with a high AVT compound back into the mix? Guess what? Everybody goes back down a notch. Isn't that fascinating? And the alpha fish, who was a female and then became a male, goes back to being a female. And the other one moves down, everybody moves back down a step. So what this seems to say, and here's the scientific term for it, is that the fish are diandric protogynous hermaphrodites, which is a long way of saying what my southern grandmother used to say. She called it the ability to rise to the occasion. Okay? So here's a perfect example of the fact that an individual being need not be limited to gender to perform great good for the group or the situation. And I think also it's, and I'll tie this in and make it fit, it illustrates what the Greek philosopher Socrates said back in the 5th century. Once made equal to man, woman becomes his superior. Okay, and once again, what this demonstrates in a very physical way is that the qualities of alpha babes, that outstanding human beings of integrity, daring, innovation, honor, interconnectedness, caring, loyalty, and vision, just happen to be in a female body. This can apply to humans as well. Okay? So we must never let our physiology be an excuse or a trap or let anyone else use it to keep us in a certain position. All right? It's just an instrument that we have.
So who are alpha babes? Well, they're flying jets, they're driving tanks, they're breaking records, they're writing symphonies, they are running corporations, they are running countries. They are, in the last couple of decades, once again, there have been so many wonderful strides for gender equality. And I think we owe a real debt of gratitude to all of those people who fought those initial battles and got a lot of this to be possible. So alpha babes are the future of humanity, as they always have been. And let's take a look at some of them from past. Now, my favorite is Pallas Athena, the Greek goddess who was born fully grown, fully armed, from her dad's head. Zeus had a headache. No wonder, right? Oh. So Pallas sort of knocked himself on the head. And this beautiful, fully grown, fully armed goddess comes out. There's just, as opposed to Dionysius, who interestingly enough was born from his father's side. And when we go into looking at the centers of motivation, note the difference there too. So Pallas Athena is the goddess of wisdom and war. Interesting combination, huh? Okay. Her symbols, you will often see her with an owl for the wisdom, with an olive branch. Certainly with the lightning bolt of her father, she was allowed to carry his shield and carry his lightning bolt, which was quite an honor. And her characteristics are wisdom, reason, and purity. Not bad. Also, in the back of your handout materials, you do have a whole page that has on it alpha babe qualities. And we'll be touching upon a number of these throughout, but that's good take-home materials for you. Okay, another one is Isis, the Egyptian goddess. Her husband, brother, lover, Osiris, was slain by his jealous brother, and he cut his body up into bits and scattered them all over Egypt. Well, Isis refused to be demoralized by this and said, well, I'm going to fix this situation. So went all around Egypt and found the bits and bobs of her husband and put them all back together again. And then, this is so interesting, she kissed him in a way that brought him, or a body part of his, back to life long enough for her to become with child, and then she gave birth to Horus, who then took his dad's place and became one of the ruler gods. Another fun goddess who does a very dramatic trip is Inanna, and she's from the Levant, Akkadian, Sumerian, Chaldean. And various stories about Inanna, but the most interesting one to me is where she has to go down into the underworld to rescue her lover, brother, husband. They, you know, guys had a multi-purpose back in these days. It was, you know, husband, brother, lover, whatever. So in going down to the underworld to rescue him, she had to give up at every step along the way some part of her identity. She had to give up her crown. She had to give up her royal garments. She had to give up her sandals. She had to give up her jewelry. And they all represent something that she had to give up until at the very end of her descent, she then walked into the underworld stark naked with no mark of any kind of rank or family or anything. Which is to say that there will come a time when you will have to do that. And you will make that descent and you must give up everything that you think you are in order to regain that lost part of yourself and then bring it back up again. And on the way back up, she did get to get her stuff back. So don't despair when you're having to give up a lot of things. You'll be on the ascent soon. The Amazons are the legendary alpha babes. Interesting too is they're called the golden shielded, silver sworded, male loving, male child killing women. And this was a description from the 5th century BC. And there's some recent discoveries around the Black Sea have turned up some burial sites that seem to indicate, yep, this isn't just a legend. Here they really were. These women, even adolescent girls, buried with all sorts of warrior icons and swords and shields and battle gear. And some of the early explorers in the New World thought that they also had encountered these warrior women, and the Amazon River was named after them in Brazil. Now, another good mythological alpha babe is Brunhilde, and she's a great one. Her story is that she was a warrior princess, the favorite of her dad again, and we'll talk about her a little bit more when we talk about love, but Brunhilde was the head of the Valkyries. And they were these warrior princess babes who rode on horses above the battlefield and would swoop down and pick up the slain warriors, throw them on their horses behind them, and carry them up to Valhalla, which is warrior heaven. Okay. Now, if you watch Star Trek and you know the Klingons, okay, that's that, all right? Klingon women are alpha babes all over the place, right? And they're patterned a lot after the Norse warriors and the Valkyries. But like I said, Brunhilde has an interesting twist to her story, which we'll get to a little bit later. A lot of times people say, oh gosh, you know, I'd love to do all these things, but I'm a mom too. That's an interesting mother alpha babe story. The Empress Jingo in Japan in about AD 200 was said to have led the invasion into Korea, which was a big deal at the time. And that was way cool. Well, when she started out, she was pregnant. And she must have said to herself, I really don't have time for this, but I want the kid. So the story goes that she held the child in her womb for 3 years. Yeah, while on campaign. And then after they'd won, she got back to the palace, and she went, okay, now. And it, of course, gave the child magical powers and such. Hypatia, who was the leading intellectual light in Egypt, the head of the Alexandria Library, killed by the early Christians, who could tend to be a little bit narrow-minded, shall we say. Vietnam has always had a problem with invaders. And there's a story of two twin sisters, warrior queens, who drove out the Chinese leading an army of elephants. So there's a great image for you, you know, these two sisters on their elephants leading this charge and driving out the invading Chinese supposed conquerors. The Queen of Sheba, we all know of her. Cleopatra ruled her empire and affected others and had as her consorts and lovers two of the most powerful men in the world at that time. Now, some would say she sort of wimped out at the end, you know, and killed herself. But you got to think of it like this. Think of like, in simplest terms, you're a basketball player, you're on an away game, it's a free throw, and everybody is against you. And they're all yelling, miss, miss, miss. She'd been a real good alpha babe up until that time. So I think we have to give her a little bit of credit. Boadicea, who was the British queen who drove out the Romans for a while anyway, and she had this really cool chariot. She had spikes fixed onto the hub of her chariot, so when she drove through the others, bloody, But it was a real effective device. She was very clever, and she's credited with being one of the first to come up with that particular very effective battle device. Joan of Arc, who listened to God and redrew the map of Europe. Short-lived, but very, very effective. Hildegard, and she's seeing a great resurgence now in popularity, and I'm sure you can find that in a number of books on Hildegard, plus her music is very popular. She's a 12th century German prophetess, mother superior, church reformer, mystic, a visionary actually approved of by the Pope, which was rather rare. She wrote over 7 books. She was a politician, a healer, the first female physician in Germany, a scientist, and a composer. She started at age 43 and then kept on going. Alexandra David Neal, opera singer, French explorer, went by herself to Tibet and was the first white woman into Lhasa, the holy city. And she has a wonderful story about all that if you have a chance to look up Alexandra David Neal. It's just great adventures and really inspiring writing. Leni Riefenstahl, think of her politics what you will. She was very much, and still is, an alpha babe. An artist, an inventor, a filmmaker. I tell you, when I was doing research for something, I had to see Triumph of the Will, which was the propaganda film that she created for the socialist movement, the Nazis. And about halfway through, I was ready to join the Nazi party. It was such excellent imagery and stirring music. The filmmaking was superb. She did a really great job of what every filmmaker wants to do, which is to draw you into the story and give you that sense of closeness and awe and imagery and binding. You go, wow, that was effective. And at 93, she is currently married to a man 40 years younger than she. She is scuba diving, and she is making an underwater movie. Now, that's an alpha babe. At 93, pretty good, huh? Leni Riefenstahl, Leni Riefenstahl. And there's also been a very good, I think it was PBS documentary done about her life that was, it's really wonderful. Bildermeier, Indira Gandhi, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Megawati Sukarno's daughter. Megawati Sukarno is the head of the Indonesian pro-democracy movement, and it was said about her, Megawati is showing people that not only can she do what men can do, but that she doesn't have to resort to revenge. She offers us alternatives. So she is carrying her father's torch of democracy and liberty for Indonesia, which certainly needs a bit of that. Aung San Suu Kyi, who is also following in her father's footsteps. He was one of the prime leaders for freedom in Burma, the country currently known as Myanmar, or as we say, Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma, to rip off Prince. She's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, pro-democracy leader, still in relative captivity, supposedly freed from house arrest, but has been separated from her husband and 2 children for, I think, going on 7 years now, and just stays there and says, no, this is what we have to do. This must change. We must talk. This must occur. The former Philippine president, Cory Aquino, who also took over from her husband when he was assassinated and led the People's Revolution that ousted the Marcos regime. I think that takes a lot of guts. To get up and run for an office that your husband has just been assassinated trying to take? That's gutsy. In Iran, the National Liberation Army is headed by a 43-year-old woman, metallurgical engineer. Her husband is her sidekick. Most of the officers of her army are women. And it is said of her, they are architects of a force so highly motivated and disciplined that it borders on the bizarre. All right, once again, we might question a few of the politics here and there, but the point of it is, it's this intensity, this focus, this accomplishment. And then just to run down a list, and there are a lot of books and a lot of studies. Certainly in Dr. Sager's book on When Women Call the Shots, you'll find wonderful listings of women in the film and television business who have made great strides throughout history. And in any women's studies group, you can find more of these listed, but let's just like Pamela Harriman, Attorney General Janet Reno, Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Victoria, I kind of think so, although there's some foibles, but don't we all have them? Maggie Thatcher, of whom a male reporter wrote of her, she is all woman all the time. Okay? The Iron Lady. Louisa May Alcott, Jane Austen, George Sand, Mary Cassatt, Amelia Earhart, Madame Curie, Shirley, what is her last name? The woman who put together the Mars rover and named it Sojourner. Okay? The director of the Governor's California Arts Council is a woman, Barbara Piper. The new director of the School of UCLA Public Policy is a woman, Barbara Nelson. Lisa Leslie in basketball, Babe Dietrichson in golf, Jackie Joyner in track, Wilhelmina Rudolph in track, Donna Demirona in swimming, and the list goes on and keeps growing. Masonry has now begun accepting women, and there are female masonry lodges. There are also coeducational lodges. In the arts, Josephine Baker, Tina Turner, of course, Susan Sarandon, Meryl Streep, Gail Ann Hurd, Catherine Bigelow, the Sarah Connor character in The Terminator, Angela Bassett's character in Strange Days, some of Gina Davis's roles, Hedda Gabler in A Doll's House, Gudrun in Women in Love, Melanie Griffith in The Working Girl, Ripley in Aliens, Lori Petty in Tank Girl. If you haven't seen it, do see it. It's a lot of fun. She's definitely an alphabet. Linda always teases me about that one, but it's a cute movie.
Not the best storytelling.
Actually, it is. It's very well structured, and it's very mythic, and it's very good. Plus, it's a lot of fun, and she wears the cutest little clothes. Okay. And, of course, Xena, Warrior Princess. Okay, so you begin to see a pattern here, right? And there's a long and vast heritage of alphabets. Who are they not? Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina. Would you throw yourself under a train? I mean, really, just because, you know, I don't think so. Femme and Louise were not alphabets. They didn't stick it out. Okay? They dove. Okay? In Sling Blade, the woman, the mother, who wouldn't stand up for her rights, and we saw where that led. Guinevere in the Camelot lore, who wimped out. The Virgin Mary. Think about it. In Women in Love, Ursula, the other sister. If you're familiar with either the movie or the book, you'll know that those sisters are dichotomous. The mom in Baseball, Apple Pie, and Mom. Not an alphabet. Mrs. Cleaver. I don't think so. Okay? And although she probably did an alphabet thing earlier on in the backstory, in Casablanca, when Ilsa says, "You'll have to think for both of us." Oh, please. Although, those kisses are really great, the ones where you can't think for 3 or 4 hours afterwards. That's great. That's great. But it's hard to be an alphabet when you can't think. First of all, to introduce myself, I'm Pamela J. Smith. The company is MythWorks. It is a global consultation and resource company serving individuals, organizations, the media arts, and the military, using ancient wisdom, new science, consciousness research, and what I have termed the proven power tools of creativity. So what I'm going to present here this evening are some of these tools. We're going to talk about tools of perception, focus, magic, creativity, balance, leadership, and empowerment. As you go through this evening, I'd like you to keep in your mind those questions that are on the flyer. Who are they? Why are they important? How can you become one, raise one, love one, and create them in your storytelling? Because a lot of the information will be applicable to various of those aspects. So we'll cover it sort of in pods, but you'll find a lot of things cross-fertilizing each other. Now, how I start most of my talks, and particularly ones to the military, is to say, don't believe anything I tell you. Okay? Because belief is an emotion that takes the place of knowledge. Keep an open mind, but keep a skeptical mind. See what the information fits in with what you already know. If it's something that totally goes against what you already know, try to keep an open mind. Stick it on a shelf, and maybe you'll find something a little bit later on that you can hook it up with and go, oh, yeah, I see. Now, the wisdom teachings have been around for, oh, thousands and thousands of years, and some say much, much longer, back into the mists of time and legend. And used to, you'd have to go sit up in a cave in the Himalayas for 10 years in the snow eating cold rice and sour yak milk to get this kind of information. But in the last couple of decades, the secret teachings have been made available. And if any of you came to the Bodhi tree 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you know how much this thirst for this knowledge and this wisdom has blossomed, and there's just tons more of it out there. So the wisdom teachings are the foundation for religion, philosophy, a lot of science. As you'll find, I've got about 3 feet of a bookshelf at home that's written by physicists about spirituality and plasma physics as the etheric network, and, you know, Einstein and how his work ties in with the Vedic writings. Okay, so we're seeing all of this blossom now. So you'll find what used to be the secret teachings out there everywhere. Esoteric is a word you'll hear me use quite a bit. It simply means hidden. It's the information that used to be secret, and you had to go through all these initiations in order to learn it, whether you were studying to be a priest in Egypt, or you were going through the Eleusinian Mysteries in Greece, or Sumerian, or Vedic, or whatever. So a lot of the stuff that was esoteric, i.e. hidden, is now coming out. And sometimes you'll hear me say something that might sound totally counter to conventional exoteric information. That's because the wisdom used to be cloaked, so that even if it slipped out, it couldn't be misused by the hoveling masses or by people who had their own agenda and would not have used it wisely. So the purpose of making people go through initiations was to test their integrity and to test their intent and to be sure that some of these very, very powerful tools didn't get into the wrong hands. And what you see a lot now also out in the marketplace are distillations of these things with, like, science of the mind, visualization techniques. These are all versions of what used to be the hidden secret teachings. If you happen to watch the news or read a newspaper, you notice that the world is changing drastically, radically. We often say it's the good news, bad news joke. The bad news is the world as we know it is falling apart around us. The good news is the world as we know it is falling apart around us. We have an opportunity to remake it. That's the good news. Okay? So do not despair when things seem really, really wretched out there or in your own personal lives. See it as an opportunity to become a conscious creator. And that's what being an alpha babe is about. A lot of people who have helped determine the course of civilization in times like this, times of great turmoil and times of change, have been alpha babes. Outstanding human beings who exemplify the higher qualities of integrity, daring, innovation, honor, interconnectedness, caring, loyalty, and vision, but just happen to be housed in a female body. And these are just the kind of people we need now more of on the planet. So we're going to take a look then at who they are, why are they important, how can we become one, love them, and raise them, and then also create them in our storytelling. How many people here are storytellers? Actors, writers, directors, producers? Okay. So keep in mind as we go through here that you can use a lot of these examples as, you know, sort of icons and archetypes for your storytelling. And as we get a little bit deeper into it, you'll get even more specific tools.
Now, as we go through this evening, I will often say man or human instead of woman or she. But let me explain something. In the Sanskrit language, which is one of the oldest languages on the planet, man means think, the person who thinks. The root word is manas, which means mind stuff, that mental plane stuff, thought forms. So the word man simply means thinker. It has no gender. Okay? So let's just put that aside and realize that when we say man, we mean human being who thinks. Okay? So, who and what are alpha babes? Out in the blue Caribbean waters is a species of fish called the bluehead wrasse. And like a lot of species of animals, they go around in groups, or herds, or schools, in the case of fish. Now, the schools are headed, as a lot of groups are, by an alpha male, who is like the totally baddest dude. And he's got the harem, and he's the daddy of most of the little kids, and he protects the territory, and everything revolves around him. And then behind him, there is an alpha female who is the head female of the group and sort of keeps everybody in line. And then there's the beta female, and then you have the juvenile males, and you've got the little babies. And so the school goes along doing what it does. Well, interestingly enough, if you take the alpha male out of the school of fish, just physically remove him, something extremely interesting happens. The alpha female very quickly changes sex and becomes the alpha male, complete to being able to make babies. There is a complete and total change of gender. Now, the interesting part about that is that it happens first in the brain chemistry and in behavior before it happens in the gonads, which is something that scientists are still trying to figure out. What does this exactly mean? Okay. Yes. Now, the chemical, the hormone agonine vasitocin, or AVT, increases dramatically when this change occurs. In humans, there are two hormones which are very similar to this same one. So what this is beginning to do is to throw into a cocked hat the whole idea that aggressive male behavior, quote-unquote, is a product of testosterone. Maybe not. There may be something more at work here. So now you got the school of fish and everybody's moved up a notch. Okay, what happens if you throw an alpha male with a high AVT compound back into the mix? Guess what? Everybody goes back down a notch. Isn't that fascinating? And the alpha fish, who was a female and then became a male, goes back to being a female. And the other one moves down, everybody moves back down a step. So, what this seems to say, and here's the scientific term for it, is that the fish are diandric protogynous hermaphrodites, which is a long way of saying what my southern grandmother used to say. She called it the ability to rise to the occasion. Okay? So here's a perfect example of the fact that an individual being need not be limited to gender to perform great good for the group or the situation. And I think also it's, and I'll tie this in and make it fit, it illustrates what the Greek philosopher Socrates said back in the 5th century. Once made equal to man, woman becomes his superior. Okay, and once again, what this demonstrates in a very physical way is that the qualities of alpha babes, that outstanding human beings of integrity, daring, innovation, honor, interconnectedness, caring, loyalty, and vision, just happen to be in a female body. This can apply to humans as well. Okay? So we must never let our physiology be an excuse or a trap or let anyone else use it to keep us in a certain position. All right? It's just an instrument that we have. So who are alpha babes?
Well, they're flying jets, they're driving tanks, they're breaking records, they're writing symphonies, they are running corporations, they are running countries. They are, in the last couple of decades, once again, there have been so many wonderful strides for gender equality. And I think we owe a real debt of gratitude to all of those people who fought those initial battles and got a lot of this to be possible. So alpha babes are the future of humanity, as they always have been. And let's take a look at some of them from past. Now, my favorite is Pallas Athena, the Greek goddess who was born fully grown, fully armed, from her dad's head. Zeus had a headache. No wonder, right? Oh. So Pallas sort of knocked himself on the head. And this beautiful, fully grown, fully armed goddess comes out. There she is, as opposed to Dionysius, who, interestingly enough, was born from his father's side. And when we go into looking at the centers of motivation, note the difference there, too. So Pallas Athena is the goddess of wisdom and war. Interesting combination, huh? Okay. Her symbols, you will often see her with an owl for the wisdom, with an olive branch. Certainly with the lightning bolt of her father, she was allowed to carry his shield and carry his lightning bolt, which was quite an honor. And her characteristics are wisdom, reason, and purity. Not bad. Also, in the back of your handout materials, you do have a whole page that has on it alpha babe qualities. And we'll be touching upon a number of these throughout, but that's good take-home materials for you. Okay, another one is Isis, the Egyptian goddess. Her husband, brother, lover, Osiris, was slain by his jealous brother, and he cut his body up into bits and scattered them all over Egypt. Well, Isis refused to be demoralized by this and said, I'm going to fix this situation. So went all around Egypt and found the bits and bobs of her husband and put them all back together again. And then, this is so interesting, she kissed him in a way that brought him, or a body part of his, back to life, long enough for her to become with child, and then she gave birth to Horus, who then took his dad's place and became one of the ruler gods. Another fun goddess who does a very dramatic trip is Inanna, and she's from the Levant, Akkadian, Sumerian, Chaldean. And various stories about Inanna, but the most interesting one to me is where she has to go down into the underworld to rescue her lover, brother, husband. They, you know, guys were multi-purpose back in these days. It was, you know, husband, brother, lover, whatever. So in going down to the underworld to rescue him, she had to give up at every step along the way some part of her identity. She had to give up her crown. She had to give up her royal garments. She had to give up her sandals. She had to give up her jewelry. And they all represent something that she had to give up until at the very end of her descent, she then walked into the underworld stark naked with no mark of any kind of rank or family or anything. Which is to say that there will come a time when you will have to do that. And you will make that descent, and you must give up everything that you think you are in order to regain that lost part of yourself and then bring it back up again. And on the way back up, she did get to get her stuff back. So don't despair when you're having to give up a lot of things. You'll be on the ascent soon. The Amazons are the legendary alpha babes. Interesting, too, is they're called the golden-shielded, silver-sworded, male-loving, male-child-killing women. And this was a description from the 5th century B.C. And there's some recent discoveries around the Black Sea have turned up some burial sites that seem to indicate, yep, this isn't just a legend. Here they really were. These women, even adolescent girls, buried with all sorts of warrior icons and swords and shields and battle gear. And some of the early explorers in the New World thought that they also had encountered these warrior women, and the Amazon River was named after them in Brazil. Now, another good mythological alpha babe is Brunhilde, and she's a great one. Her story is that she was a warrior princess, the favorite of her dad again, and we'll talk about her a little bit more when we talk about love, but Brunhilde was the head of the Valkyries, and they were these warrior princess babes who rode on horses above the battlefield and would swoop down and pick up the slain warriors, throw them on their horses behind them, and carry them up to Valhalla, which is warrior heaven. Okay. Now, if you watch Star Trek and you know the Klingons, okay, that's that, all right? Klingon women are alpha babes all over the place, right? And they're patterned a lot after the Norse warriors and the Valkyries. But like I said, Brunhilde has an interesting twist to her story, which we'll get to a little bit later. A lot of times people say, oh gosh, you know, I'd love to do all these things, but I'm a mom too. That's an interesting mother alpha babe story. The Empress Jingo in Japan in about AD 200 was said to have led the invasion into Korea, which was a big deal at the time. And that was way cool. Well, when she started out, she was pregnant. And she must have said to herself, I really don't have time for this, but I want the kid. So the story goes that she held the child in her womb for 3 years. Yeah, while on campaign. And then after they'd won, and she got back to the palace, then she went, okay, now. And it, of course, gave the child magical powers and such. Hypatia, who was the leading intellectual light in Egypt, the head of the Alexandria Library, killed by the early Christians, who could tend to be a little bit narrow-minded, shall we say. Vietnam has always had a problem with invaders. And there's a story of two twin sisters, warrior queens, who drove out the Chinese, leading an army of elephants. So there's a great image for you, you know, these two sisters on their elephants leading this charge and driving out the invading Chinese supposed conquerors. The Queen of Sheba, we all know her. Cleopatra ruled her empire and affected others and had as her consorts and lovers two of the most powerful men in the world at that time. Now, some would say she sort of wimped out at the end, you know, and killed herself. But you got to think of it like this. Think of that in simplest terms. You're a basketball player. You're on an away game. It's a free throw. And everybody is against you. And they're all yelling, miss, miss, miss. She'd been a real good alpha babe up until that time. So I think we have to give her a little bit of credit. Boadicea, who was the British queen who drove out the Romans, for a while anyway, and she had this way cool chariot. She had spikes fixed onto the hub of her chariot, so when she drove through the others, kind of bloody, but it was a real effective device. She was very clever, and she's credited with being one of the first to come up with that particular very effective battle device. Joan of Arc, who listened to God and redrew the map of Europe. Short-lived, but very, very effective. Hildegard, and she's seeing a great resurgence now in popularity, and I'm sure you can find that in a number of books on Hildegard, plus her music is very popular. She's a 12th century German prophetess, mother superior, church reformer, mystic, a visionary actually approved of by the Pope, which was rather rare. She wrote over 7 books. She was a politician, a healer, the first female physician in Germany, a scientist, and a composer. She started at age 43 and then kept on going. Alexandra David Neal, opera singer, French explorer, went by herself to Tibet and was the first white woman into Lhasa, the holy city. And she has a wonderful story about all that if you have a chance to look up Alexandra David Neal. with just great adventures and really inspiring writing. Leni Riefenstahl, think of her politics what you will. She was very much, and still is, an alpha babe, an artist, an inventor, a filmmaker. I tell you, when I was doing research for something, I had to see Triumph of the Will, which was the propaganda film that she created for the socialist movement, the Nazis. And about halfway through, I was ready to join the Nazi party. It was such excellent imagery and stirring music. The filmmaking was superb. She did a really great job of what every filmmaker wants to do, which is to draw you into the story and give you that sense of closeness and awe and imagery and binding. You go, wow, that was effective. And at 93, she is currently married to a man 40 years younger than she. She is scuba diving, and she is making an underwater movie. Now, that's an alpha babe. At 93, pretty good, huh? Leni Riefenstahl, L-E-N-I-R-I-E-F-E-N-S-T-H-A-L. And there's also been a very good, I think it was PBS documentary done about her life that was, it's really wonderful. Goldemeyer, Indira Gandhi, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Megawati Sukarno's daughter. Megawati Sukarno is the head of the Indonesian pro-democracy movement, and it was said about her, Megawati is showing people that not only can she do what men can do, but that she doesn't have to resort to revenge. She offers us alternatives. So she is carrying her father's torch of democracy and liberty for Indonesia, which certainly needs a bit of that. Aung San Suu Kyi, who is also following in her father's footsteps. He was one of the prime leaders for freedom in Burma, the country currently known as Myanmar, or as we say, Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma, to rip off Prince. She's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, pro-democracy leader, still in relative captivity, supposedly freed from house arrest, but has been separated from her husband and two children for, I think, going on 7 years now, and just stays there and says, no, this is what we have to do. This must change. We must talk. This must occur. The former Philippine president, Cory Aquino, who also took over from her husband when he was assassinated and led the People's Revolution that ousted the Marcos regime. I think that takes a lot of guts. To get up and run for an office that your husband has just been assassinated trying to take? That's gutsy. In Iran, the National Liberation Army is headed by a 43-year-old woman, metallurgical engineer. Her husband is her sidekick. Most of the officers of her army are women. And it is said of her, they are architects of a force so highly motivated and disciplined that it borders on the bizarre. All right, once again, we might question a few of the politics here and there, but the point of it is, it's this intensity, this focus, this accomplishment. And then just to run down a list, and there are a lot of books and a lot of studies. Certainly in Dr. Sager's book on When Women Call the Shots, you'll find wonderful listings of women in the film and television business who have made great strides throughout history. And in any women's studies group, you can find more of these listed, but let's just like Pamela Harriman, Attorney General Janet Reno, Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Victoria, I kind of think so, although there's some foibles, but don't we all have them. Maggie Thatcher, of whom a male reporter wrote of her, she is all woman all the time. Okay? The Iron Lady. Louisa May Alcott, Jane Austen, George Sand, Mary Cassatt, Amelia Earhart, Madame Curie. Shirley, what is her last name? The woman who put together the Mars rover and named it Sojourner. Okay. The director of the Governor's California Arts Council is a woman, Barbara Piper. The new director of the School of UCLA Public Policy is a woman, Barbara Nelson. Lisa Leslie in basketball, Babe Dietrichson in golf, Jackie Joyner in track, Wilhelmina Rudolph in track, Donna DeVerona in swimming, and the list goes on and keeps growing. Masonry has now begun accepting women. And there are female masonry lodges. There are also coeducational lodges. In the arts, Josephine Baker, Tina Turner, of course, Susan Sarandon, Meryl Streep, Gail Ann Hurd, Catherine Bigelow, the Sarah Connor character in The Terminator, Angela Bassett's character in Strange Days, some of Gina Davis's roles, Hedda Gabler in A Doll's House, Gudrun in Women in Love, Melanie Griffith in The Working Girl, Ripley in Aliens, Lori Petty in Tank Girl. If you haven't seen it, do see it. It's a lot of fun. She's definitely an alphabet. Linda always teases me about that one, but but it's a cute movie.
Not the best storytelling either.
Actually, it is. It's very well structured, and it's very mythic, and it's very good. Plus, it's a lot of fun, and she wears our cutest little clothes. And, of course, Xena, Warrior Princess. Okay, so you begin to see a pattern here, right? And there's a long and vast heritage of alphabets. Who are they not? Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina. Would you throw yourself under a train? I mean, really, just because, you know, I don't think so. Femme and Louise were not alphabets. They didn't stick it out. Okay? They dove. Okay? In Sling Blade, the woman, the mother, who wouldn't stand up for her rights, and we saw where that led. Guinevere in the Camelot lore, who wimped out. The Virgin Mary. Think about it. In Women in Love, Ursula, the other sister. If you're familiar with either the movie or the book, you will know that those sisters are dichotomous. The mom in Baseball, Apple Pie, and Mom. Not an alphabet. Mrs. Cleaver. I don't think so. Okay? And although she probably did an alphabet thing earlier on in the backstory, in Casablanca, when Ilsa says, "You'll have to think for both of us." Oh, please. Although, those kisses are really great, the ones where you can't think for 3 or 4 hours afterwards. That's great. That's great. But it's hard to be an alphabet when you can't think. First of all, to introduce myself, I'm Pamela J. Smith. The company is MythWorks. It is a global consultation and resource company serving individuals, organizations, the media arts, and the military, using ancient wisdom, new science, consciousness research, and what I have termed the proven power tools of creativity. So what I'm going to present here this evening are some of these tools. We're going to talk about tools of perception, focus, magic, creativity, balance, leadership, and empowerment. As you go through this evening, I'd like you to keep in your mind those questions that are on the flyer. Who are they? Why are they important? How can you become one, raise one, love one, and create them in your storytelling? Because a lot of the information will be applicable to various of those aspects. So we'll cover it sort of in pods, but you'll find a lot of things cross-fertilizing each other. Now, how I start most of my talks, and particularly ones to the military, is to say, don't believe anything I tell you. Okay? Because belief is an emotion that takes the place of knowledge. Keep an open mind, but keep a skeptical mind. See what the information fits in with what you already know. If it's something that totally goes against what you already know, try to keep an open mind. Stick it on a shelf and maybe you'll find something a little bit later on that you can hook it up with and go, oh yeah, I see. Now, the wisdom teachings have been around for, oh, thousands and thousands of years, and some say much, much longer, back into the mists of time and legend. And used to, you'd have to go sit up in a cave in the Himalayas for 10 years in the snow eating cold rice and sour yak milk to get this kind of information. But in the last couple of decades, the secret teachings have been made available. And if any of you came to the Bodhi tree 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you know how much this thirst for this knowledge and this wisdom has blossomed, and there's just tons more of it out there. So the wisdom teachings are the foundation for religion, philosophy, a lot of science, as you'll find. I've got about 3 feet of a bookshelf at home that's written by physicists about spirituality and plasma physics as the etheric network, and, you know, Einstein and how his work ties in with the Vedic writings. Okay, so we're seeing all of this blossom now. So you'll find what used to be the secret teachings out there everywhere. Esoteric is a word you'll hear me use quite a bit. It simply means hidden. It's the information that used to be secret, and you had to go through all these initiations in order to learn it, whether you were studying to be a priest in Egypt, or you were going through the Eleusinian Mysteries in Greece, or Sumerian, or Vedic, or whatever. So a lot of the stuff that was esoteric, i.e. hidden, is now coming out. And sometimes you'll hear me say something that might sound totally counter to conventional exoteric information. That's because the wisdom used to be cloaked, so that even if it slipped out, it couldn't be misused by the hoveling masses or by people who had their own agenda and would not have used it wisely. So the purpose of making people go through initiations was to test their integrity and to test their intent and to be sure that some of these very, very powerful tools didn't get into the wrong hands. And what you see a lot now also out in the marketplace are distillations of these things with, like, science of the mind, visualization techniques. These are all versions of what used to be the hidden secret teachings. If you happen to watch the news or read a newspaper, you notice that the world is changing drastically, radically. We often say it's the good news, bad news joke. The bad news is the world as we know it is falling apart around us. The good news is the world as we know it is falling apart around us. We have an opportunity to remake it. That's the good news. Okay? So do not despair when things seem really, really wretched out there or in your own personal lives. See it as an opportunity to become a conscious creator. And that's what being an alpha babe is about. A lot of people who have helped determine the course of civilization in times like this, times of great turmoil and times of change, have been alpha babes. Outstanding human beings who exemplify the higher qualities of integrity, daring, innovation, honor, interconnectedness, caring, loyalty, and vision, but just happen to be housed in a female body. And these are just the kind of people we need now more of on the planet. So we're going to take a look then at who they are, why are they important, how can we become one, love one, and raise them, and then also create them in our storytelling. How many people here are storytellers? Actors, writers, directors, producers? Okay. So keep in mind as we go through here that you can use a lot of these examples as, you know, sort of icons and archetypes for your storytelling. And as we get a little bit deeper into it, you'll get even more specific tools.
Now, as we go through this evening, I will often say man or human instead of woman or she. But let me explain something. In the Sanskrit language, which is one of the oldest languages on the planet, man means think, the person who thinks. The root word is manas, which means mind stuff, that mental plane stuff, thought forms. So the word man simply means thinker. It has no gender, okay? So let's just put that aside and realize that when we say man, we mean human being who thinks, okay? So, who and what are alpha babes? Out in the blue Caribbean waters is a species of fish called the bluehead wrasse. And like a lot of species of animals, they go around in groups, or herds, or schools, in the case of fish. Now, the schools are headed, as a lot of groups are, by an alpha male, who is like the totally baddest dude. And he's got the harem, and he's the daddy of most of the little kids, and he protects the territory, and everything revolves around him. And then behind him, there is an alpha female who is the head female of the group and sort of keeps everybody in line. And then there's the beta female, and then you have the juvenile males, and you've got the little babies. And so the school goes along doing what it does. Well, interestingly enough, if you take the alpha male out of the school fish, just physically remove him, something extremely interesting happens. The alpha female very quickly changes sex and becomes the alpha male, complete to being able to make babies. There is a complete and total change of gender. Now, the interesting part about that is that it happens first in the brain chemistry and in behavior before it happens in the gonads, which is something that scientists are still trying to figure out. What does this exactly mean? Okay. Yes. Now, the chemical, the hormone arginine vasitocin, or AVT, increases dramatically when this change occurs. In humans, there are two hormones which are very similar to this same one. So what this is beginning to do is to throw into a cocked hat the whole idea that aggressive male behavior, quote-unquote, is a product of testosterone. Maybe not. There may be something more at work here. So now you got the school of fish and everybody's moved up a notch. Okay, what happens if you throw an alpha male with a high AVT compound back into the mix? Guess what? Everybody goes back down a notch. Isn't that fascinating? And the alpha fish, who was a female and then became a male, goes back to being a female. And the other one moves down, everybody moves back down a step. So, what this seems to say, and here's the scientific term for it, is that the fish are diandric protogynous hermaphrodites. Which is a long way of saying what my southern grandmother used to say. She called it the ability to rise to the occasion. Okay? So here's a perfect example of the fact that an individual being need not be limited to gender to perform great good for the group or the situation. And I think also it's an tie this in and make it fit. It illustrates what the Greek philosopher Socrates said back in the 5th century. Once made equal to man, woman becomes his superior. Okay, and once again, what this demonstrates in a very physical way is that the qualities of alpha babes, that outstanding human beings of integrity, daring, innovation, honor, interconnectedness, caring, loyalty, and vision, just happen to be in a female body. This can apply to humans as well. Okay? So we must never let our physiology be an excuse or a trap or let anyone else use it to keep us in a certain position. All right? It's just an instrument that we have. So who are alpha babes? Well, they're flying jets, they're driving tanks, they're breaking records, they're writing symphonies, they are running corporations, they are running countries. They are, in the last couple of decades, once again, there have been so many wonderful strides for gender equality. And I think we owe a real debt of gratitude to all of those people who fought those initial battles and got a lot of this to be possible. So alpha babes are the future of humanity, as they always have been. And let's take a look at some of them from past. Now, my favorite is Pallas Athena, the Greek goddess who was born fully grown, fully armed, from her dad's head. Zeus had a headache. No wonder, right? Oh. So Pallas sort of knocked himself on the head. And this beautiful, fully grown, fully armed goddess comes out. There's just, as opposed to Dionysius, who interestingly enough was born from his father's side. And when we go into looking at the centers of motivation, note the difference there too. So Pallas Athena is the goddess of wisdom,
and war. Interesting combination, huh? Okay. Her symbols, you will often see her with an owl for the wisdom, with an olive branch. Certainly with the lightning bolt of her father, she was allowed to carry his shield and carry his lightning bolt, which was quite an honor. And her characteristics are wisdom, reason, and purity. Not bad. Also, in the back of your handout materials, you do have a whole page that has on it Alphababe qualities. And we'll be touching upon a number of these throughout, but that's good take-home materials for you. Okay, another one is Isis, the Egyptian goddess. Her husband, brother, lover, Osiris, was slain by his jealous brother, and he cut his body up into bits and scattered them all over Egypt. Well, Isis refused to be demoralized by this and said, I'm going to fix this situation. So went all around Egypt and found the bits and bobs of her husband and put them all back together again. And then, this is so interesting, she kissed him in a way that brought him, or a body part of his, back to life long enough for her to become with child, and then she gave birth to Horus, who then took his dad's place and became one of the ruler gods. Another fun goddess who does a very dramatic trip is Inanna, and she's from the Levant, Akkadian, Sumerian, Chaldean. And various stories about Inanna, but the most interesting one to me is where she has to go down into the underworld to rescue her lover, brother, husband. They, you know, guys had a multi-purpose back in these days. There's, you know, husband, brother, lover, whatever. So in going down to the underworld to rescue him, she had to give up at every step along the way some part of her identity. She had to give up her crown. She had to give up her royal garments. She had to give up her sandals. She had to give up her jewelry. And they all represent something that she had to give up until at the very end of her descent, she then walked into the underworld stark naked with no mark of any kind of rank or family or anything. Which is to say that there will come a time when you will have to do that. And you will make that descent, and you must give up everything that you think you are in order to regain that lost part of yourself and then bring it back up again. And on the way back up, she did get to get her stuff back. So don't despair when you're having to give up a lot of things. You'll be on the ascent soon. The Amazons are the legendary alpha babes. Interesting, too, is they're called the golden-shielded, silver-sworded, male-loving, male-child-killing women. And this was a description from the 5th century B.C. And there's some recent discoveries around the Black Sea have turned up some burial sites that seem to indicate, yep, this isn't just a legend. Here they really were. These women, even adolescent girls, buried with all sorts of warrior icons and swords and shields and battle gear. And some of the early explorers in the New World thought that they also had encountered these warrior women, and the Amazon River was named after them in Brazil. Now, another good mythological alpha babe is Brunhilde, and she's a great one. Her story is that she was a warrior princess, the favorite of her dad again, and we'll talk about her a little bit more when we talk about love, but Brunhilde was the head of the Valkyries, and they were these warrior princess babes who rode on horses above the battlefield and would swoop down and pick up the slain warriors, throw them on their horses behind them, and carry them up to Valhalla, which is warrior heaven. Okay. Now, if you watch Star Trek and you know the Klingons, okay, that's that, all right? Klingon women are alpha babes all over the place, right? And they're patterned a lot after the Norse warriors and the Valkyries. But like I said, Brunhilde has an interesting twist to her story, which we'll get to a little bit later. a lot of times people say, oh gosh, you know, I'd love to do all these things, but I'm a mom too. And it's an interesting mother alpha babe story. The Empress Jingo in Japan in about AD 200 was said to have led the invasion into Korea, which was a big deal at the time, and that was way cool. Well, when she started out, she was pregnant, and she must have said to herself, I really don't have time for this, but I want the kid. So the story goes that she held the child in her womb for 3 years. Yeah, while on campaign. And then after they'd won, she got back to the palace, and she went, okay, now. And it, of course, gave the child magical powers and such. Hypatia, who was the leading intellectual light in Egypt, the head of the Alexandria Library, killed by the early Christians, who could tend to be a little bit narrow-minded, shall we say. Vietnam has always had a problem with invaders. And there's a story of two twin sisters, warrior queens, who drove out the Chinese leading an army of elephants. So there's a great image for you, you know, these two sisters on their elephants leading this charge and driving out the invading Chinese supposed conquerors. The Queen of Sheba, we all know of her. Cleopatra ruled her empire and affected others and had as her consorts and lovers two of the most powerful men in the world at that time. Now, some would say she sort of wimped out at the end, you know, and killed herself. But you got to think of it like this. Think of that in simplest terms. You're a basketball player. You're on an away game. It's a free throw, and everybody is against you, and they're all yelling, miss, miss, miss. She'd been a real good alpha babe up until that time. So I think we have to give her a little bit of credit. Boadicea, who was the British queen who drove out the Romans, for a while anyway, and she had this way cool chariot. She had spikes fixed onto the hub of her chariot, so when she drove through the others, kind of bloody, but it was a real effective device. She was very clever, and she's credited with being one of the first to come up with that particular very effective battle device. Joan of Arc, who listened to God and redrew the map of Europe. Short-lived, but very, very effective. Hildegard, and she's seeing a great resurgence now in popularity, and I'm sure you can find that in a number of books on Hildegard, plus her music is very popular. She's a 12th century German prophetess, mother superior, church reformer, mystic, a visionary actually approved of by the Pope, which was rather rare. She wrote over 7 books. She was a politician, a healer, the first female physician in Germany, a scientist, and a composer. She started at age 43 and then kept on going. Alexandra David Neal, opera singer, French explorer, went by herself to Tibet and was the first white woman into Lhasa, the holy city. And she has a wonderful story about all that if you have a chance to look up Alexandra David Neal. It's just great adventures and really inspiring writing. Leni Riefenstahl, think of her politics what you will. She was very much, and still is, an alpha babe, an artist, an inventor, a filmmaker. I tell you, when I was doing research for something, I had to see Triumph of the Will, which was the propaganda film that she created for the socialist movement, the Nazis. And about halfway through, I was ready to join the Nazi party. It was such excellent imagery and stirring music. The filmmaking was superb. She did a really great job of what every filmmaker wants to do, which is to draw you into the story and give you that sense of closeness and awe and imagery and binding. You go, wow, that was effective. And at 93, she is currently married to a man 40 years younger than she. She is scuba diving, and she is making an underwater movie. Now, that's an alpha babe. At 93, pretty good, huh? Leni Riefenstahl, L-E-N-I, R-I-E-F-E-N-S-T-H-A-L. And there's also been a very good, I think it was PBS documentary done about her life that was, it's really wonderful. Bildermeier, Indira Gandhi, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Megawati Sukarno's daughter. Megawati Sukarno is the head of the Indonesian pro-democracy movement, and it was said about her, Megawati is showing people that not only can she do what men can do, but that she doesn't have to resort to revenge. She offers us alternatives. So she is carrying her father's torch of democracy and liberty for Indonesia, which certainly needs a bit of that. Aung San Suu Kyi, who is also following in her father's footsteps. He was one of the prime leaders for freedom in Burma, the country currently known as Myanmar, or as we say, Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma, to rip off prince. She's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, pro-democracy leader, still in relative captivity, supposedly freed from house arrest, but has been separated from her husband and two children for, I think, going on 7 years now, and just stays there and says, no, this is what we have to do. This must change. We must talk. This must occur. The former Philippine president, Cory Aquino, who also took over from her husband when he was assassinated and led the People's Revolution that ousted the Marcos regime. I think that takes a lot of guts, to get up and run for an office that your husband has just been assassinated trying to take. That's gutsy. In Iran, the National Liberation Army is headed by a 43-year-old woman, metallurgical engineer. Her husband is her sidekick. Most of the officers of her army are women. And it is said of her, they are architects of a force so highly motivated and disciplined that it borders on the bizarre. All right, once again, we might question a few of the politics here and there, but the point of it is, it's this intensity, this focus, this accomplishment. And then just to run down a list, and there are a lot of books and a lot of studies. Certainly in Dr. Sager's book on When Women Call the Shots, you'll find wonderful listings of women in the film and television business who have made great strides throughout history. And in any women's studies group, you can find more of these listed. But let's just like Pamela Harriman, Attorney General Janet Reno, Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Victoria, I kind of think so, although there's some foibles, but don't we all have them. Maggie Thatcher, of whom a male reporter wrote of her, she is all woman all the time. Okay, the Iron Lady. Louisa May Alcott, Jane Austen, George Sand, Mary Cassatt, Amelia Earhart, Madame Curie, Shirley, what is her last name? The woman who put together the Mars rover and named it Sojourner, okay? The director of the Governor's California Arts Council is a woman, Barbara Piper. The new director of the School of UCLA Public Policy is a woman, Barbara Nelson. Lisa Leslie in basketball, Babe Dietrichson in golf, Jackie Joyner in track, Wilhelmina Rudolph in track, Donna DeMarona in swimming, and the list goes on and keeps growing. Masonry has now begun accepting women, and there are female masonry lodges. There are also coeducational lodges. In the arts, Josephine Baker, Tina Turner, of course, Susan Sarandon, Meryl Streep, Gail Ann Hurd, Catherine Bigelow, the Sarah Connor character in The Terminator, Angela Bassett's character in Strange Days, some of Gina Davis's roles, Hedda Gabler in A Doll's House, Gudrun in Women in Love, Melanie Griffith in The Working Girl, Ripley in Aliens, Lori Petty in Tank Girl. If you haven't seen it, do see it. It's a lot of fun. She's definitely an alphabet. Linda always teases me about that one, but it's a cute movie.
Not the best storytelling.
Actually, it is. It's very well structured, and it's very mythic, and it's very good. Plus, it's a lot of fun, and she wears our cutest little clothes. Okay. And, of course, Xena, Warrior Princess. Okay, so you begin to see a pattern here, right? And there's a long and vast heritage of alphabets. Who are they not? Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina, would you throw yourself under a train? I mean, really, just because, you know, I don't think so. Femme and Louise were not alpha babes. They didn't stick it out. Okay? They dove. Okay? In Sling Blade, the woman, the mother, who wouldn't stand up for her rights, and we saw where that led. Guinevere in the Camelot lore, who wimped out. The Virgin Mary. Think about it. Think about it. In Women in Love, Ursula, the other sister. If you're familiar with either the movie or the book, you'll know that those sisters are dichotomous. The mom in Baseball, Apple Pie, and Mom. Not an alpha babe. Mrs. Cleaver. I don't think so. Okay? And although she probably did an alpha babe thing earlier on in the backstory, in Casablanca, when Ilsa says, "You'll have to think for both of us." Oh, please. Although, those kisses are really great, the ones where you can't think for 3 or 4 hours afterwards. That's great. That's great. But it's hard to be an alpha babe when you can't think. Turn to your next page that has the two brains. So we've talked about the chakra system and how they're all connected by these nadis that operate, the meridians of acupuncture. And we talked about how prana comes in through the spleen. And here's how that works. You've got your solar plexus, and see it's got the two little parts to it because the solar plexus is a double chakra. So energy comes in to the solar plexus where it's automatically divided and becomes pairs of opposites, conflicting energy. It goes from the solar plexus up through this nadis, through the autonomic nervous system, and into the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus then gives the pituitary gland a message that says, something's wrong out there in the atmosphere, tense up, get ready to flight, get ready to fight, get ready to whatever. Or, I feel so sad, what's going on? You pick up stuff, we swim in this sort of emotional soup, all of us sort of swim in the same emotional soup together. So oftentimes you'll pick up other people's feelings through your system. So it comes into your solar plexus, and maybe you walk into the office and there's just been a fight, or somebody's really sad. They don't have to say anything. Oftentimes you'll just get it, and you go, God, I feel weird, I wonder, what's wrong? Well, that energy hit goes up to the hypothalamus, hypothalamus talks to the pituitary tells the appropriate glands, or inappropriate, as the case may be, to do something. So they start stimulating your body. Now, you're feeling something, but you don't know what or why. Messages go up to the frontal lobes that say, hey, there's something going on in here. Now, because we are thinkers, we try to figure out what's going on and why. If it doesn't belong to you, unfortunately, what you often try to do is figure out a reason for what's happening, and you'll make something up. And you'll say, oh, I know. I'll bet I'm upset because she didn't call me back. Or, I'm upset because that guy on the road cut me off. Shows the ajna activated and processing information. Remember this net, this etheric webbing that we have that forms the pattern of who we are? Once you develop an ajna center, this information that comes in from the environment doesn't go into this gate. It goes into this gate, comes into the ajna center. And it goes straight to the frontal lobes, where you can say, aha, something's happening. What is it? What's the appropriate response? If a lion is coming after you, the appropriate response is to tell the hypothalamus, to tell the pituitary, to tell the adrenals to squirt out some adrenaline and get the heck out of there. Perfectly appropriate. If there's no physical danger, you don't want to do that because you create stress in your own body. So the ajna center allows you to be the observer. And you get better and better at this the more you live there. And you can go, aha. Because remember, the first thing again about tonight is to always assess the situation. Check out the environment. What's here? What's there? Where is the possible source of this impact? Once again, if you go into a work or a social situation and you get a hit, start looking around and see who it might be. Some people will be obvious and they'll tell you,
Others, you may just sense it, and you can go up to somebody and say, "Hi, how you doing today?" And they go, "Well, knew what you asked, not really great." And then maybe you can say something kind to them or helpful or whatever. But it gives you the opportunity to save wear and tear on your body by taking a look at what would be an appropriate response. And then knowing that intellectually, and biofeedback proves this, intellectually you can tell your body what to feel. You can tell your body how fast to beat the heart. You can tell your body to put out epinephrine to feel better. You can tell it to put out dopamine and serotonin. Now, this takes some training, and biofeedback is just incredible, that, you know, how fast people can learn to produce these results within themselves. And these are the things that, by the way, we would have spent our 10 years up in the snowy cave in the Himalayas learning too, was how to do this, which is why you've got, you know, the yogis sitting out in the snow and being able to dry wet sheets with their body heat, or to melt the snow around them for 6 feet. Just by exuding body heat. They learn how to regulate the instrument. So you do that by building an active ajna center. Okay. The whole gist of this then is to get you to consciously move into the position of the observer and to take a look when you are upset or when things are not quite an even keel, and just run a quick checklist. You don't have to run the whole centers even. Say, how's my physical body? How's my emotional body? How's my mental body? What do I need to do to bring these three into balance and into focus? And it will oftentimes surprise you which one it is that's a little bit out of whack. And eventually, though, the more you do this, the more familiar you will become with your own instrument, and the better you will become at getting that integration and getting that balance. Now, there's something that in the next couple of pages, the Ajna Focus Meditation, this is something that I suggest that you all try. Now, you take this home and do it yourself. It's about, 4 pages that runs you through an Ajna Focus. What it does, basically, is runs you through a dialogue that will calm your physical body, calm your emotional body, put your mental body in a state of poise and clarity, and then get you to, with your creative imagination, put yourself up into an Ajna Focus. And some people like to record this with their own voice so that they can then play it back for themselves, or you could have a friend, you know, read it to you, and you could tape record it. Or if you're a person who does better with reading than with listening, you know, just read it. You don't have to have your eyes closed to do it. You know, just read over this. And then there's also a suggestion of how to do a quickie version of it once you've practiced it a bit.
Okay, in this next section, we're going to talk about love, sex, and romance. But first of all, let's take a look at why we even have sex at all.
Even in embryology, it isn't until something like the 7th week that you can actually tell the sex of a baby. So everybody starts out a girl, and then you have to flip some switches to turn it into guys. So this whole story about Adam was first, and then they took the rib out. It was girls first, and then guys. Okay? And we can even prove it by the way we all develop. That's the way the system goes. In Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes tells the story of early humans who had 4 arms and 4 legs and 2 heads. And they were very happy because they just could go anywhere they wanted to do, and they were always, you know, chatting among themselves, and everything was fine. But they decided to go up to Mount Olympus, and the gods got a little concerned about this and said, "Oh, those arrogant humans, I'll fix this." Psst, zapped them, separated them. And that's why we're continually searching for our other half, okay? Because originally we were joined and together. So love for Aristophanes via Plato was that love is the desire and pursuit of the whole. And actually it is. Any of the urgings that we have, whether it's lust or love or spiritual love, is a yearning to be whole, to be united with something bigger, something more all-inclusive, something lighter than we ourselves are, just as individuals. It would be interesting to take a look at some more of the ancient observations about sexuality and romance. Now, we know that in Judeo-Christianity, the story goes like this. The babe says, the snake made me do it. And the guy says, the babe made me do it. Right? And the god, of course, says, the Nuremberg defense does not hold here. You're both out. See ya. So, women is seen as bringing in knowledge and wisdom, and for that sin, which I question, we're kicked out. Okay. Now, another way to look at it, though, is to go further back into a Judaic history, which says that Adam's first wife was Lilith. Very interesting character. Lilith, Adam's first wife, was a bit of an alpha babe. And she wasn't going to just sit around and do nothing, and she certainly wasn't going for this missionary position nonsense either, that this was the only way you could enjoy each other. And Lilith liked to be on top. Now, this is interesting when you look at the electromagnetic system, because you know how we've got the head center and the root center? Well, in Hindu and Buddhist, you'll see them, the head center is, I believe it's Sahasrara, and the root center is Muladhara, or Shiva and Shakti. So you have this separation of the sexes. And you've got feminine and masculine, or in some instances, masculine and feminine. So the difference between Lilith on top and Adam on bottom versus the new system that had the missionary position, right, Adam on top and Eve on bottom, is actually a shift. It's a polar shift, if you will. It's a shift in cultures. It's a shift in the way people were using the mechanism of the physical body for spiritual enlightenment. When you consider that most of these tales came down through the accepted propagandists of the time. So if you wanted to create a cultural shift, what better way to create it than to work specifically with the instruments that people are in? So take a look at some of these old legends and lore and think about that when you look at it and say, gosh, maybe it was really about something that was going on internally within each person, to where you're doing a shift from masculine energy to feminine energy, etc., and back and forth. Now, remember you talked about Brunhilde before? There is a very interesting paradigm that you see throughout a lot of storytelling, particularly the fairy tales. And that's the ring of fire, or the barrier around the woman. Okay, what's that about? Brunhilde was going out to battle, and her dad, the king of the gods, said, you got to throw a fight. These guys got to lose. These guys got to win. She goes, no, what are you talking about? You're for these guys. He goes, yeah, I know I am. But the council voted, and there's this new law, and I got to go this way. And you have to do this. So she goes, all right, fine. Well, she went out and did what she knew he wanted. She followed his heart, not his head, and didn't throw the battle and saved some of these people. So when she came back, he was very distraught because he was now under a new system and was required to punish her. Because she had done what he wanted rather than what he said, she was required to be punished. So he said, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to have to put you to sleep. There's this nice rock out here in the forest. It's big enough. You'll just lay out there. You can keep your sword, keep your armor on, but you're going to go to sleep for a long time. How long? Well, long enough till some of these guys forget what went on. Basically, until a guy comes along and kisses you. He goes, oh, man. Oh, thanks a lot. Here I am out in the forest, totally unprotected. Any dweeb could come by and kiss me, and then I've got to belong to him, right? Please make it hard. So
loving his daughter and seeing the sense of what she said, he said, okay, fine, I'll put a ring of fire around you so that only the bravest and the truest knight can get through to claim you for his own. Pretty cool, huh? Now, think of Brunhilde, and remember you've got a stone whenever you're talking about that root center, and you've got the feminine energy dropped into the lowest center, which is, again, the whole story of almost every culture's fall, the fall into matter. We split, and instead of holding our higher centers, we fell into the lower centers. And you've got the ring of fire around it. Often in the stories, you will have either the ring of fire, the bramble bushes, ice, something to indicate immobility. And then that energy must be, you have to break through to get into it, and then you can begin to raise the energies up through the centers. So that's the mythological and the metaphysical reason behind that. So also keep in mind, though, both story-wise and personally, it doesn't matter if it's a guy in there or a girl in there, and vice versa, whoever's coming in to break them out. It's about the feminine energy. Because sometimes in a relationship between a heterosexual couple, often some of these things can get flipped. Remember that since women have a positive emotional energy, sometimes in the romantic relationship it may seem that indeed the woman is playing a more aggressive or a more dominant role emotionally, and vice versa. So we want to be facile and not get stuck into any of this, and realize that these paradigms that you can use for your stories too, don't get stuck in gender. You know, it can be a guy. I mean, and goodness, perhaps you all have known people. I went to college with a woman who got a crush on this guy who was her roommate's boyfriend's best friend, and this guy wouldn't even talk to her. And she said, I'm going to have him. Right? And he had this ring of fire, wouldn't even talk to her. A year later, they were engaged. Okay? She just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. You know, I love you so much. And you'd go, oh, how long is this going to take? You know, aren't you getting bored yet? But, you know, eventually, it was like, it worked. Okay, so the woman can also be the character who is breaking through the ring of fire to get to a guy who represents that more passive energy, and the female is more aggressive. Okay, oh, that's a fun quote. Someone was talking about the Stockholm Syndrome, where if people are taken hostage and they're kept for long enough, they begin to identify with their captors and start to side with them, and then when they're about to be released, they don't want to go. And someone said, yeah, I've had a lot of love affairs like that. It's like, yeah, okay. Now, one of the things we want to take a look at in Alpha Babe lore is monogamy and fidelity, because these are some of the things that we're having to deal with. Certainly the United States military is having to deal with it. Certainly, America is having to deal with it. 67% of marriages end in divorce within the first 7 years. 75% of divorces are initiated by women. Something isn't working. Something isn't working. Okay. Now, some of you may have very lovely marriages, and you will be the exception, and good for you. But as a system, it ain't working. I would propose that one of the problems is you've got the centers are all operating in more people these days. So instead of having the woman only below the diaphragm in the aspirational solar plexus as the mom and occasionally as the lover, you now have women who are heart center, throat, very active throat center, very Ajna center. Well, men may be able to handle that, but the system doesn't handle it very well. Individual men can deal with it, but the system doesn't allow it very much. Also take a look at the fact that people keep harping about the patriarchy. America doesn't have a patriarchy anymore. How many households are headed by women? A majority of them, right? Absent fathers. Women are the caretakers. That's the definition of matriarchy, matrilineal systems. So we're already living in one, but we pretend like it's something else. So I think it would behoove us to just take some looks at this. Now, I don't know what the answer is, but I think we need to come up with a new definition of marriage and some new paradigms for it and some kind of new, very workable for everybody concerned way that doesn't suppress people, lock them down, isn't deleterious to children. And, see, if enough alpha babes with their visionary Ajna Center is working, perhaps we can call out and call in some answers for these problems. One of the things to do, certainly if you're in a relationship, is to try to give the other person as much freedom to run their centers as they wish. And it's very difficult to do. Instead of saying, no, you're my lover, or no, you're my husband, or you're my girlfriend, or whatever, is to see them actually just as an individual who at certain times interacts with you, but to leave them their own individuality. And I think if you even begin to talk about this among yourselves too, if you begin to see where people are at different centers at different times, you can see that sometimes, you know what, it isn't appropriate for them to be all sweetie pie with you. That's not where they are. It doesn't mean they can't be there. It's just not where they are at the moment. It's inappropriate. So one of the best things we learn is the appropriateness of the moment and the situation. In any of this, though, I would say the most important thing to remember in any kind of relationship, whether it's with your work, your writing, a writing partner, a romantic partner, a lover, a spouse, is passion. If there is no passion, what's the point? Get a roommate. No? And the problem with that, too, and you can see this just mechanics, just to the mechanics of it. If you have one of the centers not being fed, it's going to get hungry. And it's going to go somewhere else looking for it, or something else is going to come along that is going to tweak it. And you may misinterpret that, and you may say, oh, I'm in love with person X, but here I am living with person Y. You may not be in love with person X. What you may be doing is responding to the stimulation of that center energetically, even if you've never touched them. But that energy center is being stimulated. The thing to remember is, and this will sound kind of impersonal, but it is. Sometimes it really isn't about the person. It's about the energy they're carrying, because as you all know, that can change over time, and yet you can still love. When you think of the people you've loved in your life, hopefully you can use more than a couple of fingers, right? So we want to begin to differentiate between thinking that it can only come from one person, and also mistaking the fact that because it seems to be coming from over here, then it can't come from this person. Because maybe all you needed was to have a little stimulus. This is why a lot of people say, I had an affair and it improved my marriage. Okay? What it did was to wake up some part of them that had been put to sleep or had been suppressed. A lot of people don't even have to have a physical affair. They can have a mental affair or an idealistic affair. This is also where a lot of chivalric love comes in, where you have that unobtainable person, but yearning for them and trying to become a better person for them improves your life. And if through the habit of being with someone, you've shut down some centers, or you just don't pay them that much mind, or one of the biggest things people say, we don't talk anymore. Okay? Well, get that throat center thing going. And, you know, one of the clearest signs of any therapist will tell you is when you stop communicating. Okay. Obviously, you're not connecting on some of the chakras. The more centers you can get active with the person that you're with, the better off it will be. Or as one of our friends says, right, If you went from Ajna to Ajna, it's like one-stop shopping. And it is. You get like everything at once. It's really wonderful. But that's kind of rare. So perhaps you will have a love in your life that is that which stimulates your heart. And you yearn towards this person. They may not even be somebody you know. So a lot of hero worship does this. But it stimulates you to be a better person. Okay? The storytelling-wise, this is where you can get those great movies about the fan, the obsessed fan, the stalkers. Okay, where it's just that out-of-reach yearning that will stimulate one of the centers. So you want to be taking a look at where you are reacting to other people in your situations, romantic as well as platonic and work and professional, and also how you react to what you're doing. You know, and there's tons of books about this too. You know, do you wake up in the morning glad to be doing what you're doing? I'll read a little bit of a quote out of a Penthouse article by Gay Ganser, and it was about, people were talking about back and forth, the debate was about what makes the best kind of marriage. Shared interests, you can talk to each other. She goes, nah. Passion. Go for it. If you want your marriage to last, marry for passion. Forget religious values, political leaning, common backgrounds, similar hobbies, preferences and color schemes. Go for the burn. Your chances for a successful relationship are just as strong, and even if the union is short-lived, you'll have a hell of a good time before the meltdown. Right? I love it.
Would you
compare
magazine with that?
A penthouse. Yes. But it's important, you know, and this actually went out to the warrior group, too, and a lot of them responded and said, now, why exactly did you send that to me? Well, because passion's a real big thing in the warrior path, too. If you're not passionate about what you're doing, you're not going to be any good at it. So it's very much a tool of an alpha babe, of a warrior, of a magician, is passion. Let's talk just a teensy bit about a bit more about sex, and keep this in mind. And this was scary when I first heard it, and boy howdy, it sure does change your view on things. It is said, etherically and energetically speaking, that when you have sex with somebody, you can download their karma. Think about it. You can pick up their energies. You can pick up their agenda. You can pick up their fears, their foibles, their blocks, their psychological problems. So just as there are prophylactics for the body, somebody should have invented prophylactic for the soul, right? Well, actually there is one. It's called Stay Awake, Stay Aware. And there's a book called Sex and Yoga, which is in your reading list. And it talks about how as you become more highly adapted to the higher centers, you will find it more difficult to be intimate with people unless they are also on a higher level, which is not to say you don't drop and wallow now and then. It's been known to happen. But basically speaking, you'll find that it just won't click. You say, well, what am I? I'm getting too picky or what? Well, yes, you are, because the frequencies just won't match, and you become more and more aware of that. It's your tastes are becoming refined, which is good. And the nice thing about that is, too, then, is that the higher you are going in your awakened centers and your alignment, more than likely you're going to be dealing with folks in that a very similar system, and you've got more lights on. There are more places to connect. Instead of just connecting sexually through the sacral center, you can also connect through the aspirational solar plexus, through a mental inspirational, through the heart center. And it's amazing. You get, you know, wonderful, wonderful energy flows. All you have to do is just draw the diagrams, you know, like put your little BiffWorks guy and make a copy of it, and put another one over here and say, where am I and where is so-and-so? This requires you to judge a little bit, and we're not supposed to judge other people, but you want to be discriminating. So you say, where do I perceive I am connecting with this person? Because none of us can ever know where anybody really is. And it may surprise you, or it may not. You just say, that's why. Okay, fine. But definitely something to take a look at. And let's talk just for another moment, too, about tantric sex and why it's not a good idea. The system of tantric sex was built, created, and used many, many, many years ago, along with a lot of this old teaching. And it went along with death magic and sex magic, things that we don't do anymore. Right? It's inappropriate. The magic that we now do is from the higher centers. There are a lot of methods of visualization, which is basically lower solar plexus, which says, I want that Mercedes in my driveway. I want that house. I want that guy. I want that girl. Okay, and you visualize and you picture them and you just put out this energy. That's solar plexus magic. Death magic is just what you think it is. Altars, knives, hearts, sacrifices. Sex magic is a little bit different, but it was one of the old forms of magic that was used and is no longer appropriate. Tantric sex, as it has come down to us today, is a delineation of that. And one of the, this sounds like a lot of fun, one of the ways you used to get this energy charge was the couple would both be sitting in lotus position, sexually joined, try that, in the midst of a charnel house, a bunch of decaying bodies, okay? Right. Then you don't move. Nobody moves. And if you're familiar at all with tantric sex, this just happens without physical movement, you with your mind and your breathing, etc. So they both go into climax together, and then you're supposed to put your tongue back into your throat and roll your eyeballs this way and then this way so that that energy that's coming up gets redirected. You know, don't try this at home. Right? Not good. So tantric classes, you might just want to think twice before you went to something like that. I have a friend who was looking into it, and she met this guy, and they were at some coffee shop or something. He says, well, here, I can do you, you know, from across the table. It's tantric, and I can just, you know, etherically get you. I said, well, did it work? She goes, yeah, I think so, but I feel like I've been slimed. Okay? You got to watch out for this stuff. So just remember once again, etherically speaking, you can download things you may not want. So just like they always used to tell us, be careful what you do. Here's another good reason for being careful what you do. Besides, obviously, and no one has to say, you know, these days you can hardly do anything physically anyway because you have to be very, very careful because of diseases, etc. But there are more diseases than just physical diseases. Okay. Let's talk for just a moment then about this chivalric love, that yearning great love. Oftentimes, what an alpha babe will be is a muse for other people. And perhaps you have experienced this. Someone will, maybe they're writing with you or working with you, and they see you as this great light, and they begin to worship you, in a sense, or maybe literally. You know, oh, you're so great, I want to work with you. Oh, let me work on your project. Oh, tell me more about this. What a beautiful poem you wrote. So you find yourself getting up onto this pedestal. And that is part of your job also as an alpha babe, by the way, is to uphold those qualities that other people can look up to. It is your job to be an example for other people. The downside is that when you're on a pedestal, all that gets kissed is your toes, right? It can be kind of lonely. But it's definitely a position that in some aspects of your lives you certainly want to hold, whether it's an artistic muse or something in your business or for your family or whatever. So always remember that there is that aspect of being an alpha babe where you are the inspiration for other people and you are an example of the higher qualities. Storytelling-wise, you could do great with, you have a person who is that and is tempted and they fall. Or they get tired of being up there and they want a real life, so you can get dramatic conflict that way. And it is said that desire is a tool of the gods to take us where we need to go, to learn the lessons we need to learn, and do the service we need to do. So when someone is admiring you, or when you are admiring and yearning towards someone else, just as you want to take a look at which centers are being stimulated by the energy, you want to take a look at what is it really about. Because usually it isn't really about the other person. It's about what they bring out in you or what you bring out in them. There's some message that they have been sent to tell you or vice versa. And you can save yourself a lot of heartache if you look for the message first instead of falling for the messenger. But these are things you just have to sort of intuit and learn along the way. About alpha babes, one of the main characteristics is independence, emotional independence, hopefully financial independence as well. And some guys seem to be threatened by that, but I have a gentleman friend who said, as soon as women get to where they don't need you, you may find you have a lot of women around who want you. So for any guys who don't like independence, and there probably aren't too many of them left, this is a thing to remind people, is that wanting is better than needing, because it's a choice. If you just need, you have no choice in that. But you choose to be with someone, that's much more wonderful, much more valid. Okay, the raising an alpha babe, the things you want to remember are to promote balanced physical body, balanced emotional body, and balanced mental body. Teach the girls foreign languages as early as possible. They're going to need it in the 21st century. They might as well start now. Music, dance, art. Make them Renaissance girls. Okay. Also, one of the reasons for that is it builds a better brain. It helps hardwire the brain. So you can look at the page on the qualities of alpha babes and just say, how can I best instill that in a child? Writing, singing, any kind of creative activity. You always want to give them as much creativity as possible, and also help them learn how to make choices. Set it up so that you can, when they are old enough to understand some logic, you can offer them choices. Teach them how to start choosing and look at the pros and look at the cons, and then actually let them make their choice, stand behind it, and then if it fails, help them figure out why, what they can do to improve it next time. If it succeeds, add a girl. Let's try another one. Okay? Creating them in your stories, I think we've talked about all the way along through here. What I would suggest is get some books on mythology and look up some alpha babes. Work on your assessment of the centers. Go through your favorite movies and say, okay, where is this movie? Where are these characters? What arc does the character go through, and how are they running this system? And in closing, I have a couple of quotes for you. Wine is strong, a king is stronger, women are even stronger, but truth conquers all. And that's carved on a chapel in Scotland. And then from Sir James Frazer of the Golden Bough, strength of character in the race, as in the individual, consists mainly in the power of sacrificing the present to the future, of disregarding the immediate temptations of ephemeral pleasure for more distant and lasting sources of satisfaction. The more the power is exercised, of the Ajna Center, I would say, the higher and stronger becomes the character, till the height of heroism is reached in those who renounce the pleasure of life, and even life itself, for the sake of keeping or winning for others, perhaps in distant ages, the blessings of freedom and truth. Thank you all very much.